This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in a project that lasted more than 2 years, the United States government created a so-called Cuban Twitter in an effort to undermine the communist government of that island nation.
You'd think that 55 years of failed attempts to overthrow the Cuban government were enough. Apparently, it's not.
We talk about the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, a measure for which former President Lyndon Johnson is given a great deal of credit.
Possibly too much credit. He was a good politician and he got it through. But it was the movement below of black people and their allies that brought it up to Congress.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, I wonder if you would please share with our audience the recent blog piece that you wrote about the Anti-Defamation League's leader, Abraham Foxman, and his being awarded an honorary law degree by Suffolk University. Foxman had something to do with the Armenian situation. You wrote about that. Please share that with us.
Students at Suffolk University Law School in Boston are urging the school's president to withdraw its invitation to Armenian genocide denier Abraham Foxman to speak at their commencement and receive an honorary degree. Foxman, the Anti-Defamation League director, drew harsh public criticism in 2007 for opposing a congressional resolution acknowledging the 1915 extermination of approximately 1.5 million Armenians. Since the 15th century, Armenians had been treated as second-class citizens under Ottoman rule. In honoring Foxman, Suffolk University sends a message that politics are more important than acknowledging crimes against humanity. The denial of genocide is an integral and final part of the genocidal process, as Genocide Watch founder Gregory Stanton has written. Despite a well-documented body of eyewitness accounts and other evidence chronicling the 20th century's very first genocide, and it's noteworthy that scholar and lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined the word genocide in 1943 with the extermination of the Armenians in mind, the Turkish government continues to mount a campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, aggressive lobbying, and even a law which forbids mention of the word genocide. In 2005, Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk was prosecuted for the crime of insulting Turkishness, as was Armenian-Turkish journalist Tarant Dink, who was subsequently assassinated in 2007 by a young Turkish nationalist. U.S. political and partisan allegiances with Turkey enable a range of repugnant human rights transgressions, both old and new. My grandmother Baydzar was born in Giresun, a village on the Black Sea, to parents who owned almond and filbert orchards and were active in working for protection of the Armenian minority. Baydzar remembered that men would come to their house in the middle of the night and have secret whispered meetings upstairs, because it was against the law for minorities to assemble. The father of the poet Silva Gabudijian was one of those men. Many years and many worlds later, an older cousin would tell my grandmother that those men were members of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. Baydzar remembered her mother falling to her knees crying before two officers, a Turk and a German, who came to their home on horseback, begging them to spare her family. Baydzar later watched as her parents and siblings were slaughtered, before she escaped to an orphanage and made treacherous passage to the United States as a mail-order bride. Around the world, on April 15th, just weeks before Suffolk's commencement, and 99 years after the mass murders, families with stories just like my grandmother's will mark the day of observance of the genocide. April 15th is widely considered to be the starting date of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire, Talat Pasha, ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. The killings were gruesome and included beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, the use of toxic gas, lethal injections of morphine, or injections with the blood of typhoid fever patients. Although there has been much academic recognition of the Armenian genocide, this has rarely been followed by formal governmental acknowledgement. Turkey swiftly condemned a U.S. Senate committee resolution adopted just this past April 10th by the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, labeling as genocide the massacre of Armenians by Ottoman forces. And they warned Congress against taking steps that would tarnish Turkish-American ties. Similar resolutions under past presidential administrations have also failed. The Turkish people have been taught for decades that there was no genocide, with the result that most believe their country is being treated unfairly when genocide resolutions are introduced. Continued failure to acknowledge this genocide in our history books is a disservice not only to survivors, but also to those Turks who tried to stop it then and who face imprisonment now for publicly acknowledging it. Suffolk University should listen to its students. It has a chance to take a step forward in rectifying decades of injustice by reversing its decision to honor Abraham Foxman with an honorary law degree at its 2014 commencement. Tolerance of those who do not deny the Armenian genocide may be politically expedient, but it is nonetheless morally indefensible.
It's very moving. I first learned about the Armenian genocide when I practiced law in Detroit almost 50 years ago with a lawyer named Victor Papakian, whose father was in the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, and he was also the leading Armenian religious figure in the city of Detroit. And the Armenian Revolutionary Federation was a socialist organization, was part of the Second International. That's when I learned about the Armenian situation. The Jewish establishment personified by Abraham Foxman denies it. Why? Because in their ideology, the Jewish genocide, which followed the Armenian genocide, has to be unique, that Jews are the really sole victims, and that they think that if the Armenian genocide is recognized, it'll somehow undercut their moral authority in advocating for Jews, and more broadly, for the whole project of the Jewish settlement and colonization of Palestine, its displacement of the native Palestinians there, and its ongoing oppression, really apartheid, in Palestine. So that Foxman is the leading voice in America for labeling people who criticize Israel as anti-Semites. And if you're Jewish, like I am, and you criticize Israel, then you're a self-hating Jew. Foxman carried over that position into activism out in California. His organization, the Anti-Defamation League, spied on the anti-apartheid movement that was organizing to support Nelson Mandela and others in South Africa. They spied on some 600 organizations, socially progressive movement organizations, and 10,000 individuals. They did it illegally. So the prosecutor in San Francisco was about to bring a case against Foxman's organization. There was so much political pressure put on him that he dropped the case. But some of the individuals and organizations that were spied on then brought civil suits. And it was such an embarrassment to Foxman's organization that they settled those civil suits for tens of millions of dollars. It came out, for example, that Foxman's organization spied on people who were in solidarity with the movement in Central America. And that information was generated by the ADL and then given to the FBI. So the ADL worked hand in hand in spying on the movement with the FBI. And this is the man, this Holocaust denier with respect to Armenia, this is the man that they're going to honor at the university. It's a disgrace, just like honoring Condoleezza Rice at Rutgers is a disgrace. And we wish the students up there and the faculty every bit of good luck in their trying to reverse that shameful step by the administration.
Michael, we have some good news coming out of Spain. What's happened there?
Well, a Spanish court refused to close its Guantanamo torture investigation. International treaties, it ruled, take precedent over recent domestic legislation in Spain. And the judge Pablo Ruiz, said that the investigation of torture in Guantanamo should continue.
And just to note, for listeners who may not know this, the legislation you're referring to, Michael, is restrictions that were recently placed saying that Spanish courts can only investigate human rights violations committed abroad if the suspects are present in Spain.
Yeah.
So a judge ruled, basically went over that. And
exactly.
Said,
a very important ruling, because universal jurisdiction is based on the premise that if a horrible criminal is anywhere in the world, he can be prosecuted at any place in the world. And Spain is part of that international treaty that adheres to that. The People's Party in Spain, under a lot of political pressure, tried to restrict the law in Spain, but the judge wouldn't recognize that new law. And Catherine Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights said, "We are gratified that the judge rightly placed the demands of the law above any political pressures in ruling that this effort to hold high-level U.S. officials accountable for their role in the torture of men at Guantanamo Prison and other sites can proceed." And then she went on to say, "The court is sending a strong message to the Spanish and U.S. governments that it will uphold its international commitments under the Convention Against Torture to punish and redress torture regardless of who the alleged perpetrator is."
And Michael, the new restrictions went into effect last month, and they've unleashed literally a flurry of filings followed by decisions from different judges who had investigations of torture or war crimes committed outside Spain. The judges have refused to close investigations that are ongoing, and those include cases involving violations committed in Western Sahara, El Salvador, and the killing of a Spanish journalist in Iraq.
Yeah. It's a very important decision. The European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, which is the CCR's counterpart in Europe, issued a statement. The following statement: "The Spanish government introduced a law reform contradicting its obligation under international law. We welcome the decision by Judge Ruiz to continue the investigation on Guantanamo. Violations of the absolute prohibition of torture must be prosecuted."
Great news.
U.S. Agency for International Development masterminded the creation of a Cuban Twitter. The Associated Press unearthed that the communications network was designed to undermine the government of Cuba. It was financed through foreign banks and constructed through shell companies so the U.S. identification would be hidden. The project lasted more than 2 years and had tens of thousands of followers. The content initially was non-political,
such as soccer, music, weather. But once a critical mass was reached, political content was introduced to organize, quote, smart mobs that could trigger a Cuban spring, at least in the eternal optimism that seems to never leave United States, AID, CIA, and our government. Today we're joined by historian Jane Franklin, author of two important books about Cuba.
Historian Jane Franklin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
We want to talk about this particular program, which is a developing scandal of the United States setting up Twitter operation in Cuba with the attempt to destabilize the Cuban government. But to give it some background, Obama gave a speech back in November of last year on American policy towards Cuba. And I wonder whether you could summarize that for us. That'll give us some context to this Twitter program that's just coming out now in the news.
Well, yes, many Cuba analysts who thought that this response by President Obama was a positive effort on his part have to be very disappointed now, because when Obama speaks about Cuba, you have to read between the lines always and be very careful about what you think he's saying. He went down to visit the Cuban-American National Foundation chairman, Jose Mas Santos, at Mas Santos's home and gave a little talk there about Cuba policy. And he says, I think we all understand that ultimately freedom in Cuba will come because of extraordinary activists. And those extraordinary activists, by the way, were two dissidents from Cuba who were present at the party. And the incredible courage of folks like we see here today. That is, he was speaking of the dissidents. But he says, the United States can help, and we have to be creative, and we have to be thoughtful, and we have to continue to update our policies. Well, that sounded rather positive to some people. But then he said, the notion that the same policies that we put in place in 1961 would somehow still be as effective as they are today in the age of the Internet and Google and world travel doesn't make sense. We recognize, and this is the key sentence, that the aims are always going to be the same. And what we have to do is to continually find new mechanisms and new tools to speak out on behalf of the issues that we care so deeply about. So that's what he was considering back in November. And, of course, before that, this plan to use creative and thoughtful methods to infiltrate Cuba and try to create what this report from the Associated Press calls smart mobs that would eventually lead to the downfall of the Cuban government.
Jane, can you describe what's been revealed by the AP report? Because a lot of people read it, and it has this funny name, which none of us here can pronounce or remember. But if you can just give us a description of what happened and the name of it.
Sunsunio. Sunsun is the name in Spanish for hummingbird. And Sunsunio, I gather, is slang for the sound that the hummingbird makes. Sunsunio, like a whisper, a twitter.
So it's like a twitter. Okay. So tell us about the program, Jane.
There you go. And this was set up, it was budding in 2009. And then it was launched full scale in 2010 with a campaign to use 500,000 cell phone numbers that USAID had gotten hold of and send what they call blast to those 500,000 receivers. And then those people would be told that they could sign up for this program and get news and so on. And the news at first would be trivial, like sports and weather. And then gradually, according to the documents that the Associated Press has, this would increase until they could develop smart mobs, that is, street protest, that would help lead to the overthrow of the Cuban government. So that was basically the program. And they used foreign countries because they wanted to disguise where the messages came from. They were going to send them from different countries. They set up a bank account in the Cayman Islands, which is a tax haven, to use that for money. And they used the internet numbers that they had as their basis. When there was a concert, a very interesting concert in Havana in 2009, which is described in this report by the AP, and the USAID people blasted their cell phone numbers with questions. And one of the questions, for instance, was, do you think that two bands, which were not in favor with the Cuban government, should be on the stage with the band that's there today? And then they were going to use those answers. For instance, if you answered yes, they would assume that you were what they call receptive to their ideas. And they were keeping a database on the people who used their, who answered their blast. And then in, a few months later, they launched this full-scale campaign. And eventually, they had 60-some thousand receivers using their program. But that's not many in a population the size of Cuba's. So it was a failure, and eventually they closed it down because, for one thing, they were spending tens of thousands of dollars paying CubaCell, which is the group in Cuba that regulates the cell phones, and they couldn't keep doing that. They didn't have that much money, they said, although they do get millions of dollars from Congress every year to create such programs and try to overthrow the government of Cuba, which they're supposed to do according to U.S. law. The Helms-Burton Act requires that.
It's really astounding. It seemed to me that this attempt to destabilize the government of Cuba was successful most recently in the Ukraine. It's being attempted now in Venezuela. And they'll come back with another program, even though this Twitter program has been exposed. And what's interesting to me, the head of aid had to appear in front of Senator Lay's committee of the Senate. He had to pose as somebody that was operating an open program. And Leahy said, well, I read it, and I don't believe that this was anything but secret. I read this bureaucratic gobbledygook in your report. You couldn't tell this was an open program. And Shah, the head of aid, said, well, it was discreet. And Ed Lee couldn't believe that. It was a secret program to destabilize a foreign government. And as you say, something that's been the law since 1996 under Helms-Burton to do that.
Jane, but I'd like your reaction to that Senate testimony yesterday, because they claimed this wasn't about overthrowing the government. They claimed it was about just opening communications to a repressive, you know, like they do in Eastern Europe or did, et cetera.
Well, they keep saying that, but they're ignoring the fact that there was this database being put together. For instance, in the AP report, it says that a researcher for Mobile Accord, which was their main private contractor, was building a vast database about the Cuban subscribers, including gender, age, receptiveness, and political tendencies. And they believed, USAID believed, that the demographics on dissent could help it target its other Cuba programs, which is a word that words that leap out at you, other Cuba programs. So they wanted to use this to make their other programs even more effective than they were. They have these programs constantly, of course, one after the other and intersecting with each other. And one of the astounding things to me is that they were so insensitive to the fact that one of their programs went terribly wrong for them in 2009 and led to the arrest of Alan Gross, who was trying to set up satellite communications that were very sophisticated in Cuba as part of a USAID program. And he was arrested in 2009. At that point, it seems that the good thing for the State Department to do, and the State Department runs the USAID, United States Agency for International Development, and they run it, and they should have at that point said, okay, down with the covert operations for the time being because we have to think about Alan Gross. because he was accused of being part of a covert operation. Instead, they went ahead with this and even increased it, and undoubtedly other programs as well. And so now, and this is one of the ways this whole thing has boomeranged. Alan Gross, when he heard about this program last week, Sunio, he went on a hunger strike. And he is very upset that USAID would have this covert program running, which makes his situation much more difficult.
Right. He, in fact, sued the United States, I think, because he said they weren't doing anything to get him out. But it's interesting. You're the first mention I've heard that he's on a hunger strike in protest of the hummingbird in Spanish program.
Alan Gross is coming around.
Well, yes. I mean, he says he links the hunger strike to the he explicitly has linked it to the fact that this kind of thing is continuing, and his hunger strike is against both the U.S. government and the Cuba government. And he says he's being mistreated by both, and he wants them to sit down and negotiate. And meanwhile, his wife, very interestingly, has put on her Facebook a statement calling for the United States and Cuba to negotiate and saying that asking why Obama is listening to people like Senators Menendez and Rubio, and also Representative Rosleitanen, when they should not be listening to them. They should be trying to get Alan Gross. You know, those people don't want any kind of interference in Cuba on the side of anything other than overthrowing the government. And so she said, and this is the most interesting thing, she says they should be dealing with the Cuban prisoners who never had a fair trial.
Wow.
She's saying that.
That's amazing.
The Cuban Five.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she didn't say Cuban Five. She said right. Cuban prisoners, you know.
Yeah.
And
you
know, I forget exactly how she put it, but
wow.
That was right on her Facebook page. This is a wonderful thing. I hope that she continues with that, because she's right on the money there.
We shouldn't forget, Jane, that Alan Gross was smuggling sophisticated satellite cell phones into Cuba so that he could facilitate communication amongst those Cubans who want to overthrow the Cuban government. The government couldn't detect the use of those cell phones. And he did it undercover, and this is the most insidious thing. He did it undercover of saying that the Jewish community in Havana wanted this, which is not true. There's no anti-Semitism in Cuba. The truth is that the Cuban government has been most solicitous of religious Jews in Cuba. I remember one time Castro himself, during the hardship days when they were cut off after the fall of the Soviet Union, delivered Sabbath candles to one of the synagogues in Havana. For them to make that allegation that they were helping to facilitate communication amongst the Jewish community in Cuba is really scurrilous. In any case, these things are starting to blow up in their face, like the exploding cigars they wanted to give to Castro to assassinate him. It's good to see it unravel.
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, we have to think always when we're worried about what they're doing, because what they're doing is so dreadful. But there are these unintended consequences that do lead sometimes to exposure, at least, to education of people about what the USAID programs and the CIA and so on are all about. And this is one of those times. And when Alan Gross, his wife, Judy Gross, understands that her husband should be exchanged for prisoners, Cuban prisoners who never had a fair trial, that's a major boomerang against U.S. policy. And the head of the U.S. Department of Cuba's foreign ministry suggested that they sit down and negotiate this. He was responding to Alan Gross's hunger strike. And she said that they need to discuss an exchange of prisoners. And she said there's a precedent for that. And there is a precedent, of course. The United States has exchanged prisoners several times for prisoners in other countries. So, for instance, they did it with the Russians a few years ago. They exchanged Russian spies here for Russians in Russia who were spying for the United States.
We'll see if the power of the right-wing Cuban interests or such to prevent that. But it's an unfolding story. Jane, have you a website that listeners could tap into if they want to hear more? You're really one of the foremost experts on United States-Cuban relations, having written the book on it. And I wondered whether you could share that with us.
Yes, janefranklin.info. That's it.
Great.
Very simple.
Well, Jane Franklin, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we'll check back with you as the story unfolds.
Well,
thank you, Michael.
It's been wonderful to be here with you and Heidi and the other Michael.
Yes, great. Thanks, Jane. To be with you, Jane.
Take care. Yeah.
So long.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Y muy guajira, alegre cantó. Me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta. Me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta, bam, bam, para cumplir con la meta, bam, bam, de mi pequeña labor.
A caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, the most sweeping civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. The act prohibits discrimination of all kinds based on race, color, religion, or national origin. It also provides the federal government with the powers to enforce desegregation. In a speech on June 11, 1963, President John F. Kennedy unveiled plans to pursue a comprehensive civil rights bill in Congress, stating, quote, "This nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free." We're joined today by Professor John C. Britton to talk about this historic legislation and how it has been used in desegregation and other cases. Professor Britton is a tenured professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, David A. Clark School of Law. John Britton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello to you, too.
It's great to talk to you. Now, we've had a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks over the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. And Lyndon B. Johnson is getting, you know, all the credit for this. So Michael and I wanted to hear your feelings on the topic and perhaps a little bit about the movement that helped bring about that passage.
What's your take on Lyndon Johnson? Does he deserve the credit?
Yes, I do believe Lyndon Johnson deserves credit, although he had such allies as Martin Luther King as they released some of the unacknowledged tapes by President Johnson in his office in talking with Dr. King, both about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, as well as he went on to usher in the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Yet these acts, in a kind of historical respect, were a response to conditions on the ground. And the condition was apartheid in the United States, and particularly in the South. But as Malcolm X said, anything below the Canadian-U.S. border was the South. Nevertheless, it was much worse in the deep South states. And just as we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and next year of the Voting Rights Act, we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the summer in Mississippi, the major summer of outside persons, particularly youth, coming in to demonstrate and to agitate for African Americans to register to vote. So you had these series of events, including some deaths during those bus rides that provoked, actually, John F. Kennedy first, and then he died in 1963, and President Johnson, succeeding from the vice president to the presidency, carried it on. But the demonstrations in the streets, no doubt, had an effect upon the Congress in passing the 1964 Civil Rights Act to, shall we say, let some of the steam out of the kettle.
Sounds to me, John, that you subscribe to the Howard Zinn theory of history.
That's correct.
I remember when Johnson was elected in 1964. I was 22. It was the first time I had a chance to vote. I was very suspicious of the guy. He had come out of the southern wing of the Democratic Party, what they called the Dixiecrats. And there was an alliance, as you know, between the northern Democrats and the Dixiecrats in the south. And between the two of them, they kept the lid on black people's rights for over half a century. In fact, when Johnson was running for president in 64, they had to teach him how to pronounce the word Negro. He used to say Negra, and they knew that that would rub people the wrong way. So they literally had to teach this guy how to talk. Right after he got into office, he began escalating the war in Vietnam. So his legacy is a mixed one. He's not the great anti-racist fighter that he's being portrayed this week. I remember what he said about Vietnam. He said, if we don't win in Vietnam, we're going to be vulnerable to any little yellow dwarf with a jackknife. So I totally agree with your point that it was the movement from below that caused Johnson, who was an expert politician. We might want to talk about that. But it was what caused Johnson to do what he did to get the act passed.
You're quite right. He was a shrewd politician. Indeed, as you said, he came out of the Lone Star State, the only state that came into the Union as a slave state, and a state that promoted the white primary, that unless you were white, you couldn't vote in the primary. But the primary was the general election because it was the solid yellow dog South of Democrats. And yes, those Democrats, from the time after slavery up to the 1960s, made that compromise that basically the Missouri Compromise, we'd have slave states and free states, and then after the Civil War, we would have a great period of radical Republican reconstruction in the South to give a black former slaves their equal rights. But that died by the 1890s and ushered in a period of what we call Jim Crow or de jure segregation. So coming up to that point in the 1960s and with the riots, to his credit, LBJ, notwithstanding that dark cloud over his head of the war in Vietnam, which Dr. King called immoral and unjust and illegal, and took a lot of criticism for a civil rights lawyer daring to talk about international affairs, indeed daring to talk about a war. But notwithstanding, Johnson does deserve credit for declaring the war on poverty. You know, that metaphor, we like to declare a war on all our social ills, such as the war on drugs. But nevertheless, to this day, the war on poverty did provide a tremendous social benefit, such as the headliners of Medicare and Head Start. And one of the least recognized but the most successful program for the federal government to provide legal services to the poor was the Neighborhood Legal Services. I just delivered a paper on that in which it's a contradiction, because the minute lawyers went to work in representing the poor, they were cut off by restrictions. The war on poverty and Neighborhood Legal Services was started around 1965 and 1966, but a decade later, it was cut off at the knees because they created this, again, another compromise to take legal services from a grant and aid program to states where the governor, such as Ronald Reagan, could veto Northern California rural legal services because he didn't like them winning cases on behalf of the poor. Indeed, Johnson said when he was first presented with the idea of legal services that, hell, I'm not going to pay lawyers to sue the government and win, but he was convinced otherwise. But it happened no less that by the time the 65s came around and they created this compromise and started a new independent agency, federal funded, called the Legal Services Corporation, to take the political veto out of the governors, but they had to agree to restrictions. So legal services lawyers couldn't take criminal cases, abortion cases, agitation for labor rights cases, immigration cases, school desegregation cases, class action cases, you name them.
And
legal services
and
was
gay
cut
rights,
off with one arm behind the back.
And gay rights cases also.
That's correct.
John, 50 years ago, we had, as you noted, the right political environment that made passage of both the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act possible. What do you think would happen now if these two important acts were to come up again? We have such acrimonious fighting in D.C. Do you think they would pass?
No. And an example of that, again, like prior peers in history, some said we went through the second Reconstruction in the 1970s only to face a new nadir by the 1980s with Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese as the Attorney General and the attack on affirmative action. Well, just last year in 2013, on the eve of celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights the Voting Rights Act, Chief Justice John Roberts and the right wing on the Supreme Court put a dagger, as the famed John Lewis, now congressman, former head of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s, he said a decision in what is called Shelby County, Alabama, no less, versus Eric Holder, the first African-American attorney general, the cutoff of the trigger that determines what states are covered for the preclearance was a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act. A new act has been drafted and been introduced, but it's doubtful it's going to pass, particularly in this 2014 congressional election year.
John, let's get back to the Civil Rights Act, if we could. Can you tell us, in essence, what it stood for, how it was used, and what difference it makes?
Well, the Civil Rights Act, ironically, of 1964 was the same Civil Rights Act of the 1860s. The only difference is they based it on a different constitutional provision, not the 14th Amendment, that gives the Congress the right to enforce the Constitution to provide equality for the former slaves, now African Americans. But instead, in 1964, they based it on the Commerce Clause by saying that any segregation interfered with interstate commerce. The act, in essence, provided for equal accommodation, and it broke the back of Jim Crow segregation, where African Americans could go shop and go eat, go live, go play, and go to any access in parts of America. It would later take the 1968 Fair Housing Act in order to provide equal housing. So the 1964 Act gave Congress and gave the Justice Department, Department of Education too, and others, the tools to go in and to stop Jim Crow or, quote, colored-only segregation in our mainly southern states.
Was there actual litigation that was encouraged by Johnson once the act was passed?
Yes. The integration of Ole Miss by James Meredith, although a little bit before the Civil Rights Act, but that was the same Justice Department that went on to enforce the 1964 Civil Rights Act by bringing legal claims against hotels and restaurants and government facilities that continued to bar blacks from equal access.
You've been actively involved with Lawyers' Rights Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. What have they done historically to support some of these efforts?
Indeed, the Lawyers' Committee for Civil Rights grew out of the White House, ironic as it may be, when President John F. Kennedy summoned what he called some of the best lawyers. Actually, they were just some of the senior partners in the biggest commercial law firms. But nevertheless, he called them to the White House, and he said, "Where are the lawyers?" Meaning, where are the lawyers to help in the civil rights cases that other nonprofit legal organizations, such as the NAACP, the Legal Defense Fund, even Michael's TCR and its program that they had down in Mississippi in a joint effort with the National Lawyers Guild and CCR and other progressive groups. And Kennedy said, "Where are the lawyers?" By current tort terms, he falsely imprisoned them in the White House and told them they couldn't leave until they created an organization. And out of that grew the Lawyers Committee, and immediately they went down to Jackson, Mississippi, and created the Jackson Litigation Office. I happened to come along in 1969, fresh out of law school, to to become one of the lawyers in the Jackson litigation. And throughout the history, the Lawyers Committee, the only national legal organization dedicated to equality for African Americans and other people of color, have gone on to litigate in education and in voting and in housing and in employment discrimination, as well as in criminal justice.
It certainly shows that false imprisonment in some cases can have wonderful outcomes.
We're speaking with John Britton, who's a law professor and an expert on civil rights law. I remember I was in the Neighborhood Legal Services, and before that I was in another organization that was called Community Legal Counsel, which was part of the Domestic Peace Corps. It was one of Kennedy's dreams, and it was later fulfilled under Johnson, and one of Kennedy's best friends was the attorney that was in charge of it. So I was in training in Chicago, and Kennedy's friend walked into the room to greet us. He's the only lawyer I've ever seen carrying an alligator briefcase. That's how we started out in Detroit, in Neighborhood Legal Services. And for a while, we had free rein, really. It was just what you outlined. We could do the kind of things they later outlawed. But for a couple of years, we had some latitude, and we could actually make an impact.
At the 50th anniversary ceremony at the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library and Museum in Austin, Texas, President Obama referred to himself and his family as the living legacy of the Civil Rights Act. And some have noted that he's becoming a little more forthcoming in terms of talking about issues of race. For example, curbing racial profiling by law enforcement, disparities in criminal sentencing. Do you think at this point in his term, Obama will become more vocal in some of these issues?
I certainly think, Heidi, that the civil rights community hopes and urges the first African-American president, Barack Obama, to become more active in enforcing civil rights in the 21st century, and particularly address the lingering questions of racism and racial inequality, both for African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, poor people, and others. And I think he drew a perfect analogy that, yes, he is the product and the beneficiary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and other equal opportunities that have allowed African Americans, other people of color, persons with English not their first language, and poor people to gain some power in the political process. Yet, we know in 2014, the lingering effects of oppression still continue, with the disproportionality of the school-to-prison pipeline for children of color in the schools through the juvenile system into prisons, the targeting of people of color, such as Michael's own New York and the former Bloomberg's administration, of the stop and frisk of the overwhelming number of young Latinos and African Americans, the voting rights ID laws, and the reduction in the number of days or hours that voting places are open. These are all just an example of the 21st century lingering, continuing effects of racism and oppression in the United States.
At the ceremony at the Johnson Library, Representative John Lewis, whom you referred to earlier from Georgia, introduced Obama. Years ago, in 2004, the National Lawyers Guild had our annual convention in Birmingham, Alabama, and John Lewis was there. Can you talk briefly, for listeners who may not be familiar with him, of the role that he played in this?
John Lewis was a student activist back in the 1960s that led the more militant, the more progressive arm of the civil rights movement and organization called the Students. A Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or its acronym, SNCC for short. During this period, you had a number of organizations, the more moderate at the time, NAACP, and you also had the Urban League, a later CORE came along, and you can put the Black Panther Party, as well as the Nation of Islam, in that struggle for equal rights during the civil rights movement. But John Lewis was then, and has become, the modern-day face of the old civil rights. He continues to speak to the issue forthrightly, like he did to the Lawyers Guild in Birmingham, and I was there. And he continues to play a leading role in Congress, and he continues to interrelate with the highest forces of power for civil rights in this country, but to maintain his grassroots stability. So John Lewis is like Julian Bond, who was the former equal SNCC worker with him back then, and later rose to become the chairperson of the NAACP. Those lions and those giants continue to address the same issues that Martin Luther King would address today if he were still alive. I would like to say that last week, Washington, D.C., perhaps the only city in the nation, has a holiday for the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. It's 151 years old now, one of the greatest documents for freedom in the history of the United States that freed at least most of the federal slaves in the territories controlled by the United States at that time. President Lincoln issued the proclamation on January 1st, 1863. Yet to date, some 151 years later, we are challenging to consider what gains and what setbacks the African-American community and other people of color have experienced in this time, and what are the challenges that still linger and still must be overcome in the 21st century.
It sounds like a holiday we should have throughout the country.
True that.
Yeah. It's such an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. You're really a role model and inspiration to so many people.
And we hope to see you at the Lawyers Guild Convention in Chicago in the fall.
It's my pleasure and my duty to serve the National Lawyers Guild, the organization of lawyers, legal workers, grassroots people that believe that human rights are preferred over property rights.
Professor John Britton, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
We're a winner. And never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause some people mad is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes. We're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. We're moving on up. We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the good black church. And we're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up.
Johnson Publications. A whole lot of stations didn't want to play that particular record. We're a winner. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I would say the way I'm sure most of you would say, we don't give a damn, we're a winner anyway. Right on? Yeah, I got a little strength out there tonight. Putting fire under. It's all right now. We have just another version that we'd like to lay to you about here, believing very strongly in the equality and freedom for all, and especially we people who are darker than blue. We'd like to just lay another version to you, trying not to offend anyone, but basically telling it like it is. We're a winner, and never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, the black boy done dried his eye. And we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. There'll be no more Uncle Tom, at last that blessed day has come. And we're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing, like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, we're moving on up. So people get ready, I've got good news for you. How we got over, like we're all supposed to do. Let us all say amen, and together we'll clap our hands, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. Continue to be a winner, all of you.